Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. Her name is Lisa Skinner. And I'm just going to read her introduction. Author Lisa Skinner is a behavioral specialist in the field of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. In her 30-year career as a community counselor, private advisor, and regional director of senior care facilities, Lisa has helped thousands of families and caregivers understand the daunting challenges of brain disease. So anyway, I'm already crying. My mom has dementia, and so I'm very anxious to be able to ask Lisa questions and help other people who are going through this disease with their family members. So welcome, Lisa.
Hi, Hillary. Thanks so much for having me on the program today. I'm honored to be here, and I'm glad that we're going to be talking about this topic because you're right. It impacts so many families now.
Yeah. I already told Lisa I'd be crying. I'm already crying. I can't even get through the intro. So that's just the way it goes. This is Getting Real with Hillary, and this is real. So, all right, Lisa. I don't know if you want to tell them the story about your grandmother and how that was, I'm assuming that was your first foray into this disease and if that's how you started your career because of her.
Well, I actually have had 8 family members who have lived with one of the brain diseases that causes dementia. And when I use the word dementia, I'm referring to the symptoms, the behaviors, the signs. We kind of put that into a broad-based bucket called dementia, but it's a brain disease that causes those symptoms. But there's so many similarities depending on which brain disease. There are actually about 200 of them that cause dementia, but some of the more familiar ones would be Alzheimer's is the most common, the one that most of us have heard about or dealt with. And then there's, of course, Lewy body dementia, there's vascular dementia, there's frontotemporal dementia. Again, I couldn't even tell you all 200, but there are a lot of different brain diseases that all result in very similar symptomology.
And Lisa, what's the difference? Is it where in the brain it is? Is that the difference between all of them? Okay.
Yes.
So it's where it's like attacked or something.
Yeah. So the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease is it attacks short-term memory first, where frontotemporal dementia attacks the frontotemporal lobe first. And that's where we house our emotions and our reasoning and our logic. But with that said, even though Alzheimer's starts in the short-term memory, people who live with Alzheimer's disease still lose their ability to reason things out. And they, a lot of times rely more on emotions than logic and reasoning because that part of the brain eventually will be damaged too. So that's why when we put all of these terms into this bucket that we call dementia, which is referring to the symptoms, they all kind of overlap and intermingle. And sometimes it makes it really more difficult to determine what brain disease somebody is actually suffering from. People can, and a lot of people aren't aware of this, people can actually be experiencing what we call mixed dementia, where they might have Alzheimer's and a different brain disease going on simultaneously. You can have Lewy body disease and Alzheimer's at the exact same time.
So, if the Alzheimer's is the short term, I forget where that is, the short term memory, and then the frontal lobe is the emotions, what part affects the judgment?
The frontotemporal. It's in here.
So if, yeah, because I'll just say, you know, for my mom, her judgment wasn't so good. I don't know if we noticed that she was forgetting stuff, but like she was putting a plastic coffee pot on the stove to warm it up and starting a fire. Like that was one of the first things we were like, Mom, you can't do that. But she wanted to warm up the coffee, you know, like it. She lost that ability to realize that was dangerous.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And that's very common. Yeah.
Yeah. And what part is that? Or does it not matter? Like what is that? What is she losing there? She's losing reasoning, I guess.
Yes.
Or
judgment, reasoning.
Yeah. Okay. Whew. Okay. So go ahead. So you were talking about that. Yeah.
Oh, my grandma.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. So my grandmother actually was my very first experience. And it's the one that has really stayed with me even until today. So it dates back about 50 years. So I was a teenager. My grandma lived very close to us. So I saw her on a regular basis. I grew up with her. I was close with her. And I remember I had just gotten my driver's license. And I wanted her to be so proud of me. So I decided to go over and show off my driver's license. And then I drove over there all by myself. So she invites me in. And we sit down in her living room, as we typically did. And within 5 minutes, out of nowhere, out of her mouth, she starts telling me about these birds that were living in her mattress. And they would come out at night and peck at her face. But that wasn't all. Then she pointed to her walls in the living room. And she said, "You see them? Do you see them?" And I'm saying, what am I supposed to be looking at? And she says, "Don't you see all those rats running everywhere? They're invading my home." And of course, I didn't say anything. And then the last thing that she shared with me was that these men were constantly breaking into her home. They were stealing her jewelry. Her personal possessions, and she was convinced that eventually they were going to just get rid of her, do away with her, and they were going to take over her life, her identity.
Ooh.
And that she was constantly scared. She couldn't sleep at night. She couldn't eat. These birds are pecking her face.
Oh.
And I just sat there absolutely dumbfounded because I didn't even know there was anything wrong with my grandmother. Now, you know, you have to take in consideration that this was 50 years ago. And number one, it was a very stigmatized disease. We didn't even call it Alzheimer's. After this whole incident, I went home and I confronted my mom and I asked her if she knew that there was something wrong with grandma. And I told her the story. She goes, "Oh, yeah, she's been diagnosed with senile dementia," is what they called it. And I said, "Well, why in heck didn't you warn me? Didn't you tell me?" I said, "I was completely caught off guard. I'm listening to these unbelievable stories that are just, you know, so far-fetched, birds living in a mattress, and just, we're just not going to talk about it." And this was typical back then. But what I did, and the only reason why I did not contradict her or argue with her or say, "Grandma, what are you talking about? This is the craziest thing I've ever heard." Because I came from the generation where you don't argue or contradict your elders. It's, you know, respect, respect, respect. So what I did, unbeknownst to me, is I said, oh my gosh, Grandma, this sounds like a horrible situation you're in. You must be so scared. I said, let's do this. Let's go into your bedroom. Maybe you can show me where these birds are coming in and out of your mattress so I can see. And then I can call the appropriate person. Either we'll get you a new mattress or, you know, figure out some way to get rid of these birds so you won't have to be so scared. You'll be able to sleep at night, and we'll address each of these things that are happening. And it turns out that was the right approach. Mm. But I didn't know it at the time because I was like 16 years old. And it's what we practice now. I'm a certified dementia practitioner, and I practice a therapy called Join Their Reality and a person-centered approach to dementia care, which is the opposite of the old therapy that we call reality orientation therapy. And that was, if somebody was having a false belief, and the birds in the mattress, I was witnessing a false belief. And it's a very common behavior in people with dementia. The rats, I was witnessing a hallucination. She actually believed that she saw those rats running around her house. And then the men breaking in and stealing her jewelry, she was displaying a very common behavior that we see, and that was suspiciousness and paranoia and fear. So in that very short visit that I had with her that day, I was experiencing three different very common behaviors that are a result of the damage being done to the brain of the person living with the brain disease. And in her case, we were told it was like Alzheimer's disease. Mm. So I learned a lot in the last 50 years, but because I was caught so off guard with my grandmother, and that whole experience just has stayed with me all these years. And then seven more family members followed in her footsteps. I kind of hear the same theme with almost every family I have worked with in the last 30 years. And that includes, you know, actually assisted living and memory care, and then having my own counseling service. And, you know, I've done over 300 of these interviews raising awareness about this disease. And the one common thing that I have realized that is going on with family members and caregivers is they don't completely understand how this disease is changing the brains of the people who live with these diseases. It's right. Not just because, you know, the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease, for example, is short-term memory loss and confusion. But a lot of people just believe it that that's all that happens to the people, is they become, you know, terribly confused and they lose their short-term memory at times. But it's so much more complicated and complex than that. And that's the missing piece of the puzzle. So I figured out years and years ago that if people have a better and more comprehensive understanding about how these diseases change people's brains, and the result of that changing brain are the symptoms, are the signs, are the behaviors that we see, like I saw in my grandma, then I can help them be more prepared. They can recognize these as being part of the disease. And I teach people how to effectively respond to anything that comes up to minimize the situation from escalating into like a total meltdown. We call that Well, I flew out of my head, but anyway, a meltdown.
Yeah.
And that happens on a regular basis. So that was a really good.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? When you say change the brain, like what is it actually doing to the brain?
That's a great question. It depends on what the brain disease is. But with Alzheimer's disease, it's these plaques and tangles that are forming in the brain. And they're literally like killing off and suffocating our brain cells.
So it's. No, I'm forgetting the word. So if it's killing off the brain cells. Well,
these plaques and tangles that are forming.
Yeah.
Brain.
So then part of their brain just is like dying. So they don't.
There's a lot of atrophy happening. If you look at a photo of a healthy brain side by side with the brain of a Alzheimer's disease person, the size of the brain is actually has shrunk and much smaller than the healthy brain.
And they don't know what causes any of this, right?
Well, they definitely have seen the plaques and tangles in the autopsies of people after they've passed away with the Alzheimer's symptoms. The thing that we don't know yet is that the only cause of Alzheimer's disease?
And there's no way to eliminate or prevent the plaques and tangles, right? Like what is...
Well, there have been studies that have been done for decades that are showing correlations between the risk factors that we know exist that will increase a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's disease or minimizing their risk. And just by knowing the risk factors and then implementing like healthy lifestyle choices and treating medical conditions that you may have, we've seen that correlation that can minimize, but there is nothing that we can do to completely prevent any of us from developing Alzheimer's disease.
And can you say what the risk factors are?
Oh, sure. It's a little bit long. Is that all right?
I mean, just like a flavor. So we get the flavor of it.
Okay. So there's two aspects to these risk factors. The first category we call the non-modifiable risk factors. There's only four of those. So the number one risk factor in developing Alzheimer's disease is a person's age. And we say that's non-modifiable because we can't change our age, right? And Alzheimer's typically strikes starting at about the age of 65, with the exception of early onset Alzheimer's, which shows up younger than 65, but it's a rarer type of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So starting at age 65, for every 5 years that our age advances, it increases our risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. So right now, by the time any of us are 85 years old, 1 in 3 of us will be displaying symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Yeah.
Okay.
And the thing that's really concerning and why I feel it's so important to have these conversations and to raise this awareness is because we are being told and forewarned by the World Health Organization, the Alzheimer's associations, that just in the next 25 years, so by the year 2050, the number of people who are expected to develop Alzheimer's disease is going to triple worldwide.
Hmm.
And we are not prepared as a society for that increase of Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is unless a cure or a treatment is found between now and then. But if there still isn't, then the number of people who will develop Alzheimer's disease is expected to triple. Okay. So age is number one. The second non-modifiable risk factor is our gender. We know more women develop Alzheimer's disease than men. Oh. Plain and simple.
Okay.
And we can't change our gender. Well, we can, right. But, you know, if right. you don't.
Right.
Okay. The third is genetics.
Hmm.
Now, Alzheimer's disease does tend to run in families, but there's also a gene that we can inherit from either our moms, our dads, or we can inherit one from both. It's called the APOE4 gene.
Ooh.
And there's a test for it. And you can either inherit one of those genes or both. And if you have two, if you're carrying two APOE4 genes, that means that you inherited both from your mom and your dad. If you have one of those genes, it increases your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. If you are carrying both, two of them, that increases your risk even more. Now, does that mean that you're definitely going to develop Alzheimer's disease? No, it doesn't. It just increases your risk versus somebody who's not carrying any APOE4 gene. And then the last non-modifiable risk factor is our ethnicity. So we know, and this is through, you know, science-based research, that there are certain ethnic backgrounds that do tend to develop Alzheimer's disease more than others. So Hispanics are at a very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. African-Americans, Asians and Pacific Islanders are four of the highest risk categories. But anybody, I mean, I'm Caucasian and I've had five of my eight family members have been blood relatives. The other three were through marriage, like my mother-in-law had it. So I know I'm at a high risk for developing Alzheimer's disease just because it's prevalent in my mom's side of the family.
Right.
Does that mean I'm going to get it? No. My mother didn't have it, but three of her sisters did and her mom. Mm. So those are the non-modifiable risk factors. So any of those risk factors that apply to any one of us are stacked against us, obviously.
Right.
Then we have the other category of modifiable risk factors. So I'm going to tell you some of those. And then if any of those apply to you, you have to add those to the non-modifiable ones. And the more that apply to any individual, the higher your risk becomes of developing Alzheimer's disease, but it still doesn't mean you will. I want to assure everybody because this is a scary thing.
Yeah.
All right. So the number one modifiable risk factor, believe it or not, is cardiovascular disease. So anybody who has any type of heart disease, heart condition, increases their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. The difference is it's treatable.
Hmm.
So then if you are suffering from high blood pressure or hypertension and it's being treated, then that can cut back the risk, that risk factor. Diabetes is huge, but can be treated again, a health condition that's treatable. Sleep apnea is now known to be a risk factor. But a lot of people who've been diagnosed with sleep apnea use CPAP machines.
And what does that actually mean, the sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea is you actually stop breathing X amount of times a night while you're sleeping.
It's not you just wake up. It's you actually stop breathing.
Stop breathing. Oh. So they hook you up to these
Yeah.
things, and they measure you go for a sleep study, and in a 12-hour period, I think it is, they actually can see how many times each individual has stopped breathing. And the more you stop breathing while you're sleeping, the more severe of sleep apnea. And the thing is the reason why this is a higher risk situation is because people who suffer from sleep apnea are not getting restful night's sleep. They're like not going into REM sleep. And very interrupted sleep patterns. And now we know that increases a person's risk of developing Alzheimer's.
So, all right, we're going to have to take our commercial break already, believe it or not. But thank you so much for this great information. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about how people can manage when someone has already been diagnosed, right? And
yeah.
Yeah. Which is important too. Okay. Well, it's all important, but all right. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Hey, it's Hillary from Getting Real with Hillary. I want to share something really powerful with you today. Jerry Dale was deep in the music industry, providing girls, drug, and gambling opportunities, all while justifying it as making a living for his family. He questioned his path, but then God turned his life completely around. Now Jerry's on a mission to redeem and help others find their way back from the dark side. Jerry's book, Music, Porn, and Jesus, A Journey to Redemption, is his raw, real-life memoir of how God rescued him from the music industry, the porn world, and his own rebellion. It's not just a story. It's a testimony of grace, hope, and freedom. Visit IamJerryDale.com to get your copy and join a movement of redemption. If God can do it for Jerry, he can do it for you too. Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary show and Getting Real movement is all about. Being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon, my courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, in case you feel stuck in your life and want to get inspired. How I came out about my no sex life and my marriage in my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. as always, to our sponsor, KokoriApp.com. It's a social-emotional learning platform that actually helps kids learn better while having more fun. The teachers love it. The kids love it. And if you want to make a difference in your, you know, children's lives, and if you're a teacher in the students' lives, it really can make a difference. I just interviewed Kendra Bostick, who's the founder and owner of that company, and what she told me about how kids can learn, you know, how kids get labeled. Really, this platform can make a huge difference for all kinds of children, for building communities, and for learning. So check it out, KokoriApp.com. And now we're going to go back to Lisa Skinner, who's teaching us so much about, you know, brain disease and all that. And I know, I'll just say, you know, when my mother first started, you know, not remembering things, and I'm ashamed to say, I would tell her, Mom, I just told you that. And I know that's the absolute wrong thing to do, but I just didn't know. So, you know, reading Lisa's book, I wish I had read it, you know, 5 years ago when it just started, Truth Lies in Alzheimer's, Its Secret Faces. She really goes through how you can, you know, understand what's going on so that you don't make them feel worse, because you know what? She couldn't help it. And I didn't know any better. And so I, you know, Lisa's goal is to bring this to people's awareness. And I wholeheartedly agree, because, you know, not only did it not help, but I was ashamed of myself, you know, I was trying to be more patient, but I didn't know how. So anyway, I will let you talk, Lisa, please, please tell us how we can serve our loved ones better and have more compassion for ourselves as well.
And this is the thing. The average period of time, just from the onset of the symptoms, when you really realize that, oh my goodness, there is something seriously wrong with my mom here, or my dad, or you're caring for somebody who's, you've been told, has Alzheimer's or one of the other brain diseases, just at the onset of the symptoms, the average time a person lives is 8 to 15 years. My grandmother lived 20 years beyond the day that I found out birds were living in her mattress. The point being is that's a very, very long time to go through this experience, to go through this journey with your loved one or in taking care of somebody, because as most of you probably are aware, these diseases progress. There's no cure to date. There's no treatment to date. And they eventually decline to a point where they need full-time care. But it takes a very long time. So if you're on this journey with somebody that it's very painful for you to be on the sidelines watching them decline, you want to try to provide them with the healthiest, most purposeful, joyful, meaningful time that you have. And that is almost impossible to do, as a lot of family members have found out and caregivers, if you're constantly at odds with that person because you're trying to correct them. You're trying to fix them. And don't beat yourself up if you have. I'm guilty of it too. It's our natural instinctive response. We're wired that way to fix things we care about. So if I go visit my mom in a memory care, and the day I show up, she doesn't even know who I am. A lot of family members feel extremely hurt that their own mother or father or whomever, grandma, grandpa, doesn't even recognize their own daughter. And the first thing out of their mouth might be, Mom, it's me. It's Lisa. Don't you recognize me? How could you not know your own daughter? That's our gut reaction. It's our instinctive reaction. But we have found through trial and fire that it doesn't work. And it increases the anxiety and the stress between both parties.
Mm.
Because in that scenario, my mom doesn't remember who I am. Because think of it this way. If your short-term memory, and I use this as the analogy that I use because people can really relate to it. It's like, oh, that makes total sense. So I'm going to share it with you. So let's say your short-term memory is hooked up to a switch, like a light, like a lamp. And starting from about the mid stage of Alzheimer's disease through the duration of the disease, that switch flips on and flips off. Now, in the middle stage of the disease, it's probably on, your short-term memory is functioning properly, and then that switch flips off just kind of unexpectedly.
Randomly.
About half the time.
Wow.
And then as a person progresses through the disease, that short-term memory switch starts flipping off more than it stays on. And by the end of the disease, it's pretty much off either most of the time or completely. So by the end of the disease, people are left with absolutely no short-term memory, but our long-term memories stay intact for the duration of the disease. And when our short-term memories have basically short-circuited, whether it's on a temporary basis or a longer term basis or a permanent basis, we then start pulling from our long term memories. And this is the exact reason why you might go visit your mom and that particular visit, that particular moment, she's not recognizing you. And the reason why is because what you're witnessing is her short term memory switch has flipped off.
Hmm.
So she's gone back in her reality, in her mind, to a different timeline of her life. So if she's not recognizing you, she might be believing that she's 25 years old now in her mind, in her reality, because again, she's pulling from her past memories. And either you might be a baby or a toddler, but you know, she's in her reality, if she's only 25 years old, she couldn't possibly in her mind have an adult daughter standing in front of her insisting that she's her daughter. Because in her mind, you're either very young or she hasn't had you yet.
Right.
Does this make sense?
Yeah.
So what you have to do, and this is what I teach, is you have to listen to what they're telling you as your cue of where they are in their life's time frame. So if you go visit and your mom maybe calls you a completely different name, she may recognize you. You look very familiar. But in her mind, if she's only 25 years old, she couldn't have an adult daughter.
Mm.
But because you look familiar, she might think you're her next door neighbor or her sister or somebody else that she thinks she's familiar with, but relates to her when she was 25 years old, not 85 years old.
Right,
is this making sense?
Yeah. That's great.
Okay. So what you have to do is listen and follow her cues and then join her where she's at that moment.
Right.
And what we have found, and this is part of a person-centered approach to care and join their reality ideology, is go with her flow. Because even though you're the one with the healthy brain and you live in the real reality, she's also living in a reality that's her reality. And they're incongruent at that time. They don't line up. But that doesn't mean that she doesn't believe what she believes at that time. And what we've discovered is there's absolutely nothing that any of us can do or say to change a person's reality until that short-term memory switch flips back on and she's back into a congruent reality with yours.
It's great.
So to try to correct her, to try to say, no, Mom, this is Lisa. I'm your daughter. It's not going to work. And it just creates tension and anxiety and stress for everybody. You know, I've had family members say, I'm constantly fighting with my mom because, you know, she repeats everything she says. And I just, I mean, I'm ready to explode. She's not doing it on purpose. That short-term memory is malfunctioning at that time. And she's not remembering she just asked you for the 12th time the same question or shared with you the same story in that conversation. And it takes an incredible amount of patience, an incredible amount of understanding. We literally have to retrain our brains to be able to do this because it doesn't come naturally for us. But it's what we have found is the effective approach to when this happens. So when I say follow her cues, if I show up the next day and she knows exactly who I am. Oh, Lisa, I'm so glad to see you. I was hoping you'd come see me today. I mean, obviously she knows my name, and I think it's a pretty good chance that she knows I'm her daughter. And then that's your cue that, okay, her short-term memory is working just fine today. If she confuses me with somebody else, that's your cue that it's not. It can, that switch can come back on at any given time or moment. We don't know when, but usually in the mid stage, it's a temporary situation. And the thing that is a little bit comical is the reason why it's so important to follow their cues and listen to what they're telling you so you can figure out where they are on their life's timeline is because if you went the next day and the day before she didn't know who you were, she knew she recognized you and you looked familiar, but she thought you were somebody, you know, 50 years earlier. If you go the next day and expect that she's still not going to recognize you, then, and you start joining her reality and going along with being the neighbor or the sister or somebody else, she's going to respond to you like, Lisa, what's wrong? Why are you talking like this? What's going on? So only join your reality when you have figured out where they are in their life's timeline. Because trust me, it can flip on and flip off with no notice at all. And I've had people kind of get caught in the join their reality where that's happened. And they kind of assume that the next time they see him, they're still going to, their short-term memory switch is still going to be off, and it wasn't. And their relative is going, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Wow, that's crazy.
So the point is follow their lead, their cues to be able to determine where they are at any given moment. But that's the reason why we see this, you know, shift in, you know, them in just anything that they believe at that moment, because sometimes they are in the current here and now. Because that short-term memory switch is on and the short-term memory is functioning just fine. And other times it's off, it's flipped off, and you don't know where they are in their life's time frame. And they could be talking about things that make absolutely no sense to you, but they make perfect sense to them. And unfortunately, the onus is on us to figure out if that switch is off or on, so we can then join them where they are, not where we are. And I hope this makes sense and this kind of shines a light on why there's so much unpredictability that happens with dementia And this is the very reason. But it goes way beyond that with this disease.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that. We touched on it briefly because people also lose their ability to use reasoning, to use judgment. I'll give you one quick example. Every single one of us was conditioned from a very young age that before we ever cross a street, I don't care if you're in a crosswalk or you're jaywalking, you look both ways for your safety to make sure no cars are coming in either direction. Or if you're in a crosswalk, you wait for the light to turn green. And then it becomes second nature. We don't even have to really think about it. We just do it. People living with brain disease, they eventually lose that ability. And that person will not stop and say, oh, I need to look both ways to make sure that it's safe for me to cross the street. And they'll just walk out in the street. So that's one of the things that happens.
Mm.
They lose their ability to sequence familiar tasks. I'll use brushing our teeth as another example. We're taught at a very young age to brush our teeth. And when we're first being taught, we know that we go through a series of steps from A to Z to go through that process. By the time we're grown up, we don't give it a second thought. Okay, take your toothbrush out of the toothbrush holder, run it under the water, put the toothpaste on, and, you know, yada, yada, yada. People lose their ability to follow a sequence of tasks. So you could have, you know, your mother standing at the kitchen, at the bathroom sink, staring at that toothbrush and not remembering what she's supposed to do with it. So you might have to help her by cueing. Okay, mom, pick up the toothbrush and then let her do that and see if she can remember the next step.
Mm. Wow.
People who live with dementia don't even remember simple, you know, like how to operate a simple appliance that they've been using for decades. They can just all of a sudden forget. Now, how do I turn my coffee maker on again and brew my coffee? I'm staring at this thing. I don't even know what I'm supposed to do with it. That happens all the time. And then they lose their emotional control. So what seems to you to be just no big deal at all can be a huge deal to them. And all of a sudden they're really upset and, you know, kind of having a meltdown when what happened, and of course we have to figure out what triggered this, all of a sudden becomes a great big huge scene. Mm. And you're trying to figure out what set her off, because they eventually lose their ability to control their emotions, and then they're reacting on raw emotions.
Hmm.
Fight or flight.
Yeah.
So my point being is anybody who's not aware of these things would not realize that what they're witnessing is part of the disease, but the positive aspect of it is there are a lot of strategies, kind of what you were saying with your books, Hillary, strategies that people like me who've been trained in this arena know to teach families that can minimize a situation from escalating into this big ordeal. And I just remembered, we call the meltdowns catastrophic reactions, but it's synonymous with somebody having just a total meltdown.
Mm.
And it's all in the how we approach the situation. It's all in how we respond to whatever comes out of their mouth, how we respond to what they're responding to, their behaviors. But the positive part of it, the encouraging and hopeful part of it, is by learning these things and possessing this knowledge and assembling a toolbox for yourself, any given situation that comes up, you'll be more prepared to de-escalate it and diffuse it than if you keep trying to correct, trying to argue, and the entire relationship that you will have moving forward with your loved one, especially as they, you know, are declining, will just always be at odds with each other. And that's not a healthy place for anybody to be. But it doesn't have to be like that. We know now what works.
Right.
But most people aren't aware of it because this is their first experience with, you know, something as serious as your brain being damaged.
Mm. Lisa, thank you so much. We're almost out of time. I have one quick question that's on my mind, and I know it's on the minds of a lot of people. You know, when we can't remember a word, you know, it's just not coming to our brains. And it seems to happen to a lot of people. Is that a sign of dementia or is that just aging? Like, is that something to be concerned about? I know a lot of people who are like, oh my God, I can't remember this word. What would you say? Or do we not know?
It can be either. And that's why it makes this disease so difficult to diagnose in the earlier stages, is because it actually can just be part of normal aging forgetfulness.
Hmm.
But I can honestly say that, you know, periodically, if you can't remember why you walked into a room, or you can't remember the right word to fit into the sentence, or your friend's name, if it's just happening once in a while, it's probably just normal aging, and it starts happening to all of us around 40, I would say. But if it becomes more severe and is happening more often, and it becomes blatantly obvious that there's something more serious going on than just normal aging forgetfulness, then I would recommend that it's time to be assessed by a doctor, because it could be a brain disease that is, because we can live with brain diseases for, you know, up to a decade and show no symptoms. And then all of a sudden, so it's a complex answer, because it could be normal aging, but probably you were not going to know until the person's into their mid stage that, oh my goodness, there's something serious going on, because now these signs and these symptoms are impacting their ability to function in their life. That's the difference.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. All right. And now we need to wrap it up. What would you like to say in about 60 seconds or less? Your vision for the world, you know, what you'd like to, what if your mission was successful 5 years or 10, how would the world look?
I want to give everybody the gift, because this is such a difficult disease, to watch somebody decline, to stand by and watch, to try to have a loving relationship with your loved one or care for somebody going through this. I want to be able to give everybody the gift of having a more meaningful relationship with their loved ones, and have a less stressful time going through it with them by empowering them with the right tools and information to allow that to become their reality. And it is possible, trust me, with less medication, and just it takes knowledge and new skills. And that's the gift I want to impart on anybody who's listening to this today, that if it hits your family, if you're currently going through it like Hillary is, that there's a better way. Mm-hmm. It exists out there. You just have to know about it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. And please, you know, if you have someone or you have concerns, check out Lisa's book, Truth, Lies, and Alzheimer's. It's Secret Faces by Lisa Skinner and Douglas Collins. And thank you so much, Lisa, again, for the work you're doing, for the difference you're making for all of us in a difficult situation. So thank you.
Thanks again for having me. It's been a pleasure. And I hope this has been helpful for so many people.
Yes, it was for me. So thank you. All right. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.